are very fortunate to have with us this afternoon so articulate and insightful a writer and commentator as Amélie Schlaes. A magna cum laude graduate of Yale, Ms. Schlaes has authored 4 New York Times bestsellers: The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression; The Forgotten Man, Graphic, that's an illustrated version of the same; Coolidge, a full-length biography of a president who is probably too often himself a forgotten man; and The Greedy Hand, How Taxes Drive Americans Crazy. She has won the Hayek Prize from the Manhattan Institute and the International Friedrich Bastiat Prize for writing on political economy. Ms. Schlaes has been a J.P. Morgan Fellow, a Bradley Lecturer at the American Enterprise Institute, and has served on the Council of Foreign Relations. Her articles and essays have frequently appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Bloomberg, the National Review, and other publications. Ms. Schlaes is married to journalist Seth Lipsky, and they have 4 children. Please join me in welcoming our speaker, Ms. Amélie Schlaes.
Can you hear me? Do I echo? Raise your hand if I echo too much. We have Anthony making this perfect. The thank you for this speech comes in the middle. It's very difficult for us to write a speech. I actually wrote this speech for this group. It is not canned. But in the case of President Coolidge, our 30th president, writing a speech wasn't just difficult. It was agony. You could ask Mrs. Coolidge about that. Agony. Writing a speech seemed to Coolidge an interruption, a squandering of time. Another loss, he actually had to leave Washington to give a speech. And it was only in Washington that he, as president, could complete the tasks he had assigned himself: craft tax plans to outwit the progressives, stop the progressive bloc, cut the budget, write another thing, a veto. All those things happened in Washington. Sustain civility and peace, sustain prosperity, all those things. In short, Coolidge was busy as president and busy ensuring that prosperity that Ingrid referenced last night and called upon us to replicate. So Coolidge resisted requests for speeches whenever he could. And when sometime in early 1926, well into the 3rd year of his presidency, a nonprofit approached him about giving an address in Philadelphia and then spending time touring the city and maybe looking at the bridge, maybe lunch with the mayor, Coolidge resisted. They grew pressured, and they pressured, and they pressured, and Coolidge finally relented to the speech part only, not the trip, not the tour, and he relented crabbily. So the president told his staff and the press corps and anyone who would listen, by the way, "You men who go around with me know the work of my office and know what it is necessary to do and realize it is a considerable task to prepare an address and then make the necessary arrangements to go out of town and deliver it." So the inevitable took place, and of course this trip, this one speech he'd agreed to, did, you could tell from the correspondence, morph into an obligation to spend 24 hours in Philadelphia, full day of touring. And when the president saw that, he exploded. "All that I ever had in contemplation was to go there and make an address." A few days later, you can hear this in his press conferences, Coolidge was vacillating again. "I want to go to Philadelphia, but I don't have time." And actually, he did go, and he did speak, and he even stayed extra hours for lunch with Mayor Kendrick and saw the new bridge. And the reason Coolidge was willing to do this was because of the date of the speech, July 4. president can't brush off a date like that, the date our founders put the final touches on the Declaration, a date that had so much power in shaping our country. And Coolidge was always aware of the fragility of our constitutional government. He was aware of Ben Franklin's statement to the lady who asked what kind of government the men in the building were fashioning. A republic if you can keep it. A republic if you can keep it. You may know, too, that the president was actually born on the 4th of July. The only president. That made, from his Puritan point of view, the whole obligation even heavier. He had been born to serve the 4th of July. The sesquicentennial, this was the sesquicentennial, right? And that part of his duty was to speak and keep the republic for Ben Franklin, right? Keep the republic. And that, I think our very humorous David gave you a sense of the current situation. Keeping our republic is also a concern for us here in 2016. Maybe we're a little more concerned than we were in 2015 at the Philadelphia Society meeting. And this is the quarter millennial 16 of the Declaration, not the sesquicentennial, which was in Coolidge's time. So it seems especially appropriate to look at the speech Coolidge did in the end write and deliver, an astounding speech that is routinely anthologized even by people who are no fans of Coolidge. It's appropriate that we think about it here in this room because you are the Philadelphia Society. I cannot think of a group who understands better what I'm trying to get at than you. But the greatest relevance of the Coolidge speech in Philadelphia, which is sometimes called the inspiration of the Declaration, is his topic, keeping the Republic. Good principles, good policy, good results. These had long seemed to him the proper focus as executive. But now in 1926, he was wondering whether principles, policy, prosperity on their own do suffice. Maybe you suppose that a nation will continue to improve itself in some kind of virtuous cycle with good government, good results, good prosperity. But maybe that isn't so. Maybe republic, well, it goes to democracy. And then democracy disintegrates into bread and circuses and not a republic at all, or even a democracy, but an autocracy. In fact, his whole career represents a kind of two-step inquiry into that question. And we at the Coolidge Foundation are asking it all the time. With me in the room are two fellow Coolidge scholars, also trustees of the Coolidge Foundation, Bob Luddy and Garland Tucker, over here. And I know you two do, whether at Hillsdale, Claremont, or many, many people in this room have studied Coolidge. This particular story takes a minute to trace, and I'm very grateful to you, the Society, and to Ingrid Gregg, who invited me to have these moments to detail the speech for you and remind you what happened. So the story does start, Coolidge, 1923, with the goal of prosperity via policy. Balanced budget, strong growth, good jobs. But how to achieve these things? Coming out of World War I, the U.S. economy was in a rocky state. Our debt was far higher than the founders had imagined, than even William Howard Taft had imagined. And the tax revenue, well, we needed that, but the top tax rate was already 73%. Our ability to cut back was constrained by pressure from a new strong movement no one had expected, interest group, the progressive movement, and there were two particular interest groups who were leaning all over the government for what we would call an entitlement, the veterans and the farmers. So Coolidge, from the safe vice presidential seat, observed all this, but it is only in the summer of 23, when Warren Harding passed away, that he had to think about what he would do. Next year, the Warren Harding revisionist will be up here for you. I felt a little guilty about passing Harding so fast. The two things that Coolidge knew he had to do, that we had to do, one was to cut the government back, and that is to say no to those interest groups, balance the budget, maybe, And the second was to pull government's hand back from commerce. He used the word commerce, not business, to leave commerce room to flourish. You know the famous quote of Coolidge, the chief business of the American people is business. And the way to do that was to loosen the shackles upon the people, well, to reduce taxes. That was obvious. That was very American in the Tea Party way. I mean, the old Tea Party way, but the new one. It was kind of a rebellion after all. And Coolidge did note this in his speech. The reasons for the declaration, he thought, at first, were largely economic. The colonists objected, I'm reading Coolidge, to navigation laws which interfered with their trade, and they denied the power of Parliament to impose taxes they were obliged to pay. Anyhow, achieving all these goals would not be easy. The vets, they were numerous. You know there was universal conscription in World War I. You know that up to one-third of these hundreds of thousands of vets were disabled. And this is when the American Legion grew strong. I think Richard Viguerie is in this room, and he'll know within about a minute the American Legion had 834,000 members who were seeking this new entitlement, and you know what you could do with that in direct mail terms to the White House. The vets wanted something. They wanted, when they retired or sooner, a regular payment, an entitlement. And the other group, the farmers, farmers are small in number today, but then they were half or quarter of the population on the land, and they'd seen prices go up and down like this, commodity changes, right? And they wanted what? A regular payment to smooth it over. And this is all made even more difficult because who was representing the farmers? It wasn't the other side. It was the Republicans who were in Coolidge's own party, that dangerous, progressive, populist wing that was hijacking Coolidge's Republicans. Nothing ever changes, right? And they didn't want to cut taxes. They wanted maybe to tar and feather Henry Ford, or at the very least, and this did happen, force him to make public his tax return and post it, along with all the other plutocrats, on the wall at the post office. Our tax law did say that for a brief minute. The progressives got it. And people, in addition, didn't have a high opinion of Coolidge, who fell into the office. They called him the accident of an accident. He was small. Even his bodyguard, the Secret Service man, called him the little fellow, the president. He had red hair. And this crowd is good at arithmetic. August 1923, well, that's 14, 15 months until the election. Lame duck, right? Lame duck. In fact, as far as I can discern, the phrase lame duck was first used to apply to a president with Coolidge. They expected he'd compromise with the vets. They thought he'd crumple before the farmers. But this new president was determined. And he settles into the White House, and he decides to marshal all his experience, which is actually considerable, because he was a Massachusetts politician and had climbed the ladder all the way up in Massachusetts from mayor of Northampton to governor, that he was going to utilize every political tool at his disposal, every insight. In a way, Coolidge was like Lyndon Johnson, who came much later when his president died. That increased his determination to honor the past president and to show his ability in service of the president they had lost. And Coolidge vowed to execute the policies he and Harding had promised, open quote, to perfection, period, close quote. That's a high bar to give yourself. And he didn't come on like a duck. He came on like a tank with the mendicants, the vets. He just didn't believe the country could afford to pay all the vets would demand, so he kind of rolled over them. He also didn't believe, more importantly, it was right. He always looked for the moral part of the equation, too, even here. No, I'll read you some Coolidge, no bonus is owed. No bonus is owed. The respect and honor of their country will rightfully be theirs, the vets, forevermore. But patriotism can neither be bought nor sold. It is not hired on salary. We must either abandon our theory of patriotism or this bill. He proved equally tough with the farmers, and people look for weaknesses in a president. Coolidge came from New England. You know what they farm in New England, right? Rocks, right? He knew what it meant to suffer as a farmer or to just subsist. Farming executive, actually someone from the farm board came to see him kind of to try out the case for an entitlement for the farmers, a regular payment, a price support, something like that. And here you have Coolidge's very legendary silences at work. Listen not to what I say as Coolidge, but to the silences between the phrases I utter. Here's Coolidge. Well, farmers never have made much money. Pause. Don't suppose they ever will. Pause. Don't suppose there's much we can do about it. Those two vetoes, and he vetoed, of course, both those bits of legislation, were among 50 by Coolidge. To give you an idea, Harding, a good fellow, vetoed 6 times. And Coolidge likes something called the pocket veto. It appealed to him as a technician. The pocket veto, as you know, takes some art. Congress has to pass a bill near the recess, and then the president sits on it, right? He puts it in his pocket. He doesn't sign it. But you kind of have to lure Congress into passing the bill. So they have to have some hope that you are going to sign it, right? It's a little... pocket veto has 2 powerful advantages. One is you don't have to write a veto message. Silent Cal like that, right? No pain. And the other is it cannot be overridden. And Coolidge was overridden often. The poor congressmen have to start all over and write a new law after a pocket veto. Coolidge wasn't just good at the pocket veto. He was a maestro of the pocket veto. He was a regular Isaac Stern of the pocket veto. And the country knew it by the end. In the inspiration of the Declaration, this speech now, he laid out why he had this courage to veto. Under a system of popular government, there will always be those who seek for political preferment by clamoring for reform. While there is very little of this that is not sincere, there is a large portion that is not well informed. There is far more danger of harm than there is hope of good in radical changes. The next area, the tax cuts. This was also difficult. Coolidge valued tax cuts. Mr. Tucker and I were just talking about this because he valued personal freedom. Save people, not money. He wanted government to be cut back so people would have more for themselves. His Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, wanted those tax cuts too. But what if by pursuing your second goal, low taxes, you actually undermined another goal, cutting government and balancing the budget? Cut the rate, right? And if anyone had a reputation as more silent than Silent Cal, it was Silent Andy Mellon, this Treasury Secretary. So it's kind of hard to know how Silent Cal and Silent Andy wrote a tax plan. Some people said they knew. It was said that Coolidge and Mellon conversed in pauses. Anyhow, Mellon told Coolidge, the magnate from Pennsylvania, told the governor from Massachusetts, the attorney, that if they cut rates, they might get more revenues because lower rates would mean more business activity. Okay. Secondly, Mellon said the lower rates might lure more millionaires into the system and increase the burden on the rich, paradoxically. There were only 74 millionaires listed in the statistics of income, the Treasury document for 1923, and they paid only 5% of the taxes. And these ideas made Coolidge's inner Scrooge profoundly uncomfortable. Well, there's no scenario he liked. If you cut taxes and you don't get revenue, you do the opposite of what you promised. You widen the deficit. Horrors, right? And if you cut taxes and you do get, that is, cut tax rates, and you do get more revenue, extra revenue even, well, then there's extra money and the Democrats will take it. and spend it and expand government. But he went along because he believed in the principle of delegation and comparative advantage, and he knew that Andy knew better than he did, and the pair of them mounted a furious tax campaign and got the top rate after much struggle down to 25%, which we know now why Reagan put Coolidge's picture back in the cabinet room, right? It's even lower than 28%, Reagan level. Oh, and specifically, all the theses Mellon had put forward, well, they played out. The millionaires paid more tax, and they had a bigger share of the burden, 15% in the lower rates. There were more millionaires in the tax system, 511 instead of 74. So this was a textbook natural experiment. I mean, documented for the textbooks that we turn to even today. He's completed the things he said he would do. The interest groups are unrewarded. The prosperity is here. The taxes are low. Today, some of our candidates speak of 4% growth, but that number 4% is frankly aspirational. In those days, it was reality. Because of Coolidge, we had 4% growth. And he did what, as far as I can tell, no peacetime president, peacetime, has done since. He cut the budget, actually cut it over a long time and didn't merely reduce the increase. And there you have it, a utilitarian fait accompli. Here we are, we studied, right? Still, it's 1926, and Coolidge is ready to step back and ask himself, the nation, this question. We cut government back, we did it, but what do we cut government back for? One answer would be typical of the one we'd get now, more fun, more consumption. You remember the efficiency experts, Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, and Cheaper by the Dozen, right? They were basically productivity experts. Why do you attempt to make an economy run like clockwork? Why do you care to reduce the work week from 6 days to five, as they did in the 20s? So you have more time for yourself. What Gilbreth said is a famous phrase. He said, for education, for beauty, for art, for pleasure, for mumbledy-peg, if that's where your heart lies, for games, that's why you cut back. That's why there's prosperity and productivity. Another answer, more freedom, for political freedom. Liberty is not collective, Coolidge said elsewhere. It is personal. The fundamental conception of American institutions is regard for the individual. Well, if government is smaller, that's easier. But with these answers, his own answers, Coolidge was not entirely satisfied. He wondered about prosperity. This was the era of Great Gatsby, and just around the time that the country was preparing for the Philadelphia sesquicentennial, the first film version of Great Gatsby was being made by the studios. And Coolidge knew what those pictures were, people wasting time with champagne at parties, and he did not see that as entirely benign, the party of the 1920s. So readying himself, he wasn't sure that prosperity would put us on a surer path. So readying himself for Philadelphia and writing the same speech, he attempted to supply an answer that goes beyond any of these replies. You push the state back to leave room for something. For what he called things of the spirit. You might not look too much to government, you might not respect that hierarchy, but that does not mean you respect nothing but yourself. There might be another place you are looking, another way you are looking up. The Declaration is more than a pragmatic document that works, it is an idealistic document. And I want to read you just now, as we come towards the end of these pages, what he said in the speech about the limits of science. We live in an age of science and of abounding accumulation. These did not create our declaration. Our declaration created them. Elsewhere, he adds some thoughts about whether the declaration itself is the end point and sufficient, the ultimate document or the ultimate principle. And these are some of the most striking lines we have ever heard about the declaration. About the Declaration, Coolidge wrote, there is a finality that is exceedingly restful.
It is often asserted that the world has made a great deal of progress since 1776, that we have had new thoughts and new experiences which have given us a great advance over the people of that day, and that we may therefore very well discard their conclusions for something more modern. But that reasoning cannot be applied to this great charter. If all men are created equal, that is final. If they are endowed with inalienable rights, that is final. If governments derive just powers from the consent of the governed, that is final. No advance, no progress can be made beyond these propositions. Those who wish to proceed in that new direction cannot lay claim to progress. They are reactionary. Their ideas are not more modern, but more ancient than those of our revolutionary fathers. I think Professor Watson is in the room. He's writing a book about this, so we return to him soon. Of course, scholars of natural law, natural rights, will hear Coolidge going yet farther. The Declaration is not merely excellent policy or even a document whose ideals inspire. It is an expression of something spiritual that antedates the framers. The things of the spirit come first, says Coolidge. Unless we cling to that, all our material prosperity, overwhelming though it may appear, will turn to a barren scepter in our grasp. Speaking of our ancestors and the framing, Coolidge noted that the framers were only great because of something that influenced them. They were a people who came under, note the preposition, under the influence of a great spiritual development, and then acquired great power. He goes even farther. The principles, the policies, the prosperity of America are based on the Declaration. The Declaration is based on things of the Spirit, and things of the Spirit in turn are, or he suggests may be, based on faith in God. We hold that the duly authorized expression of the will of the people has a divine sanction. The ultimate sanction of law rests on the righteous authority of the Almighty. The sense of the spiritual didn't just come from somewhere. I think he's maybe criticizing Thomas Jefferson. It didn't come from a breeze or the beauty of a flower. It came from him. This divine authority was not something Coolidge had ever denied, if you go back and study all his writings as we do, but he hadn't emphasized it too much until about this point, till Philadelphia. We must not sink into a pagan materialism and watch reality television. We must cultivate the reverence which they had, the framers, for things holy. We must follow the spiritual and moral leadership which they showed, our framers. Remember, this is 26. It is 26. The election is in 1928. Coolidge's successor, the utilitarian Herbert Hoover, has already anointed himself the next president. So Coolidge is planning his own farewell. In fact, we know that in the next year he would announce his decision not to run again, really clear the way for Hoover, and he was reading George Washington's own farewell address. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. Or, as Washington also said, and let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. And that is about where Coolidge, too, came out. He didn't insist on display of faith at every turn. As chief executive, he certainly didn't force organized religion in unconstitutional ways upon the polity. But he also did not and could not deny the power of faith. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, but it might observe existing laws, including from heaven or actually laws in a state, right? There's no complete closure for him here personally, just as there's no closure, no pure finality to the Constitution. There are spaces in between, and when we read his papers and letters, we see that to the end of his days, Coolidge wondered aloud in speeches to himself whether faith was a necessary or merely a nearly necessary, a possible cause for sustained success in a republic? Necessary or possible? Still, the very details of this speech in Philadelphia can give us an inkling of the direction in which Coolidge finally inclined, to which he leaned. It actually happened that that year, 1926, the sesquicentennial, July 4, the date of the anniversary, fell on a Sunday. We see from the 1920s, from the newspapers, that the trend in Philadelphia was to disregard old blue laws and hold non-church events on Sunday. That very August, Connie Mack would schedule a Sunday game for the Philadelphia A's against the White Sox. And they beat him. So what about Coolidge? Keep the fourth or keep the Sabbath? When you consult the presidential diaries and the papers, you come across an interesting fact. This president, the man who studied July 4, who was born on it, in the end waited to give the July 4 speech of his life, the speech of America's life, until noon on Monday. On July 4, Coolidge went to church. Thank you very much.